situation where you're losing patience. Take your time and look her in the eye. When you just can't find the words you want, and it's hard to reach a point where you both can understand. Don't just tell the truth, but tell the whole truth. It'll make a better man out of you.
When you talk to her like it was somebody, talk to your mama.
Don't get smart.
Don't get smart, but I have a heart to heart with her, just like you would with your daughter.
Cause everything you do,
everything you do or say,
and everything you say
every day. She's somebody's baby. She's somebody's sister. She's somebody's mama.
Skirt or a business suit, whether she's 25 or 99, treat her the way your mama taught you to. She could be the queen of Sheba, she could be a school teacher, a homemaker or a lawyer. I think it's good for your karma if when you talk to her. Nothing in the world could ever exist without its opposite. There has to be a sun and a moon, a man and a woman, and that's just the way it is. Humanity's one-sided, and everybody's fighting. How do we restore the peace? Mother Earth is hurting, and everybody's searching for that feminine energy. You gotta talk to her.
Ooh, and welcome to Solidarity Not Charity, the weekly program of the African People's Solidarity Committee. We are broadcasting today, and of course we want to, as always, thank the African People's Socialist Party for giving us this hour each week here on Uhuru Radio, allowing us to try to speak to other white people like ourselves who want to take a stand in solidarity with African liberation. We work under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party, and we just express our most profound appreciation for their vision in struggling to solve the problems of the revolution, leading a way for the future world, and as a part of that, forming the African People's Solidarity Committee, allowing a place for white people to be able to take this stand and be with the people and making a new world. And we just really, really, really appreciate that. And we appreciate having this time each week to be able to talk to you. Downstairs at the, we were broadcasting from the Uhura House in St. Petersburg, Florida today, at the Uhura Radio Studios, and downstairs at the main auditorium. There's a program getting ready to begin that I know is going to be a wonderful Mother's Day program celebrating African motherhood and Mother Africa. And it is Mother's Day, so I want to say happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there, and also to all the revolutionaries who are struggling to give birth to a new era of human society, a way, way better era. And a special tribute and honor and recognition to African mothers who have, for the past over 500 years, faced the most just impossible hurdles to overcome, whether it be, you know, the highest infant mortality rate in the world, highest maternal mortality rate in the world during childbirth, of mothers dying for simple, just stupid, you know, solvable reasons like, you know, not having the clinics, not having the care, not having the nutrition to allow them to have healthy children and healthy births, and then all the way to having to worry every day when their children leave the house, are they going to come back safe and alive, or are they going to be brutalized or worse from imperialist white power and imperialist violence that they face wherever they are in the world. So special honor, tribute, recognition to African mothers throughout the world. Today on Uhuru Solidarity Not Charity, we're going to continue with our broadcast dealing with the bringing you excerpts and material from last week's Uhuru Solidarity Movement Conference. It took place up in Philadelphia. Last week, we brought you the opening presentation made by African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess. And today, we're going to bring you the keynote presentation made by African People's Socialist Party Chairman Omalia Shatela. And it's really a treat. And I think you'll really enjoy it. So with no further ado, here is African People's Socialist Party Chairman, African Socialist International Chairman, Omalia Shatela.
We have entered into a new era in human history. And I think this new era that we have entered into is something that gives context to the significance of this conference of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. There has been already discussion by Penny and allusions by other people who preceded her about the profound changes that are obvious in the world, struggles that people are making everywhere for freedom. This is something that really began to be pronounced, these struggles, with the advent of the Second Imperialist War that's often referred to as World War II. Because, as you know, the last 500 years of world history has been a history of imperialism. It has been a history of the white domination of the rest of the peoples of the world by arms, by guns, terror, etc. And beginning with the Second Imperialist War in particular, we saw an escalation of the struggles of oppressed peoples around the world to win freedom. It's not that people learned of the need for freedom with the advent of the Second Imperialist War. People refer to it as World War II. And they talk about it as being a war that was fought for democracy. You've heard all of the trite. In fact, they say it was the last good war that America has won, has fought. But the truth of the matter is that the Second Imperialist War, just like the first, was a war to redivide the world, a war essentially among white people to redivide the world, to redivide the stolen loot. It was like a gang war where different partners had become dissatisfied with their cut and had set out to rearrange things by making war, and they did rearrange things. People, countries, the whole countries were changed hands as a consequence of this war. Whereas with the Second and First Imperialist War, going into the First Imperialist War, part of Africa, like Rwanda, was owned by the Germans. But the Germans were on the wrong side of the war. They were on the losing side. So the good guys, the good white guys, then gave Rwanda to the Belgians, who were on the right side of the war. That was the First Imperialist War. The Second Imperialist War was another war that was designed to change the split among the thieves. So this whole notion about a war being fought for freedom, for democracy, is nonsense, especially when you saw in this country one of the highest rates of lynchings during that period where Africans couldn't even go to a school without being killed, or even couldn't register to vote as a Democrat, which was, everybody knows, has not been an organization of revolution of freedom. When the ones who fought this so-called war for freedom and democracy, England, France, the United States, Belgium, and the rest of them, controlled colonies around the world. In fact, England, up until the Second Imperialist War, alone controlled 25% of the world's population and some 25% of the Earth's surface through colonial domination by gunpoint. So from the perspective of the enslaved masses of the world, there were no good guys in the Second Imperialist War. There were no good guys in that war. But as a consequence of this war, when you saw the European powers preoccupied with struggling against each other, enough space emerged, political space, that freedom struggles around the world began to take great leaps. Kenya, the Kenyan Land Freedom Army called Mau Mau, which actually really began the struggle around 1948, fought an incredible battle against the British. And so in 1947, I think it was, India became formally independent. 1949, China became independent. You saw these leaps of struggles around the world, again, because the Europeans were preoccupied with each other and it left enough political space for these struggles to develop. And going on, not only in places in Europe and Asia and Latin America, as you know, the U.S. worked overtime to crush struggles in Latin America. 1954, they overthrew the government of Arbenz in Guatemala. They did not anticipate the Cuban Revolution and its implication in 1959. And then subsequent to the Cuban Revolution, how in part as a consequence of the influence of that revolution and the desires of the peoples throughout Latin America, you saw revolution sweeping Latin America. It was a time where the masses of peoples around the world did not look to charity by white people anywhere on earth for their freedom, but were taking freedom ourselves. Because we needed to be free, because we needed the lynchings and murders to stop, because we needed the end of this thing that they call convict leasing, or however it was being characterized any place in the world. People demanded freedom, wanted freedom, and did everything they could to win their freedom. And that was a responsible thing for any people on earth to do, to struggle, strike out, to win freedom from a parasitic social system that rested upon the body of humanity like a cancer and still does, even to this day. That's why we talk about the injustices that's inflicted upon the peoples around the world. That's why, even as we hold this discussion, someplace right now there is, on a news station, somebody talking about the economy, and they're talking about an economy that is consumer-driven. Here in this country, 75% of the gross domestic product is driven by consumer spending right here. But they don't say where the resources come from that are purchased in the malls that are increasingly closing around this country. It comes from someplace, and it has come up to now rather cheaply as a consequence of colonial domination of the peoples of the world at gunpoint. That's not trade. That's not trade. I mean, Jesse James, according to that scenario, was a free trade guy when he hopped on the train with a gun and took everything that was there. So it wasn't charity that anybody depended on. It was people's having determined they had a right to be free and struggling for that freedom. And then everybody else all around the world who could unite with the right of peoples to be free did so. And sometimes it was difficult, especially in Europe and North America, for folk to unite with the right of peoples to be free because of how we had all been defined, because of how we all saw our material interests. Think about it. Here you have a situation where people are lucky enough or fortunate enough to have a dwelling, a mailbox. It's a dwelling on stolen land. The reason that it is possible is because of the genocide or near genocide that was committed against the indigenous populations of this country. And that even now, as we hold this discussion, where there are concentration camps that they call reservations, where people are locked in there with a lifespan in the 40s, right now. So when you talk about freeing the indigenous peoples and giving them back everything that has been taken from them, you're talking about giving up your house and everything else. What am I supposed to do? Give up my house? Right? And that's why it's so easy for Europeans and North Americans to hate the Arabs, to unite with the concept of the dirty Arab, the how do they characterize the Muslim fundamentalists, Islamic fundamentalists? Because as long as they can be so characterized, you can justify doing everything necessary to murder them and keep control of them so that you can keep the oil prices, the gasoline prices, as low as they are. So it's possible for people to see a stake in keeping the world just like it is. Keep the Arabs down. Keep the Negroes down. Keep the Mexicans, the illegal aliens across the artificial border. Just created, just a recently created border. Where half of Mexico, of course, was split from the other half through theft, through at gunpoint. Right? So, it's easy for somebody, in fact, there's a way that some of the what are characterized as conservative pundits have defined Mexicans coming across the illegitimate border. Mexicans say, we didn't cross the border crossed us. Right? But some of the so-called conservative pundits define Mexicans coming across as La Reconquista. The reconquest. And I like that statement. Because in that statement is implicit recognition that California was stolen, Texas was stolen, New Mexico was stolen, Arizona was stolen, half of Mexico was conquered. That's the only way you can have a reconquest. It was stolen in the first place. But it's easy to unite with the notion of keeping the so-called illegal aliens out under those circumstances. And it's easy to be willing to give charity to the poor Mexicans at the borders who are having so many problems. Send them a care basket. It's easy to support some haggard movie actress who runs over to Malawi to steal an African baby. Isn't she a nice person? It's easy to be supportive of some charity program that's helping the poor Negro child in West Philadelphia. Help him stay out of crime. Help him go to a good school. The rest of it. That's charity work. And it's possible to do charity work today because of the limitations that has existed up to now in the liberation struggles of the oppressed peoples. Because there was a time in this country when the Black Panther Party and the revolution was strong. Nobody was talking about doing charity work. You had to make a decision whether you supported the revolution or you supported Rizzo, who was trying to crush the revolution. In Vietnam, the Vietnamese weren't saying send a care basket. They were struggling against U.S. imperialism, and it made white people in this country take a stand. You either stood with the Nixon regime and everybody else who were trying to murder the Vietnamese, or you stood on the side of the Vietnamese, or you stood on your own side, because if you knew if you took your ass to Vietnam, the Vietnamese might send you back in a body bag. So, over the last period, of course, in the 1960s, what we saw was a revolutionary movement that came under assault in a serious way. What Europeans were beginning to support, or some, especially in the North, as a kind of charity, civil rights effort, because all the Negroes wanted was to be with the white people. That's all the immigration. They just want to be with us. They just want to be like us. They just want to talk like us. They just want to go to school with us. They just want to marry our daughters. I mean, those are all honorable aspirations. Most of the white people could at least unite with aspirations, even if they didn't want you to do it. I mean, those are wonderful things to aspire to. That shows that the Negroes are becoming more and more mature. The more they want to be like white people. people, the more civilized they are becoming. And so, even if someone wasn't willing to support that aspiration, they could appreciate that aspiration. They could see there was something good in that Negro. He just wants to be like me. He just wants to be with me. He just wants to marry my daughter. He just wants to live next door. I'm wonderful. Right? I'm wonderful. And so it's easy to be charitable under those circumstances. And then the movement is crushed. But not before this nice civil rights movement had matured. And then something had happened to it. And this movement that started off as this alliance between liberal whites and liberal sector of African petty bourgeoisie had somehow got overturned, overcome, if you will, with the movement for power, black power, etc. And even people who were recalcitrant and in supporting King learned to love King when they heard Malcolm X say, by any means necessary, right? But finally, after this movement had really developed and it had actually begun to address the real contradictions that African people suffered from, which were the contradictions that the majority of the oppressed peoples around the world suffered from. And what we suffered from was not the ability to live with white people. In fact, we were much better off before we met white people, before we heard of white people. Oh, yes, we were. It was white people who were rescued by this relationship, not us. Right? Oh, how unsettling that kind of discussion can be. Especially when one is so accustomed to being the subject of history and seeing the rest of the world as simply objects of history. So the rest of the world is just something that defines who we are in the world, right? Inarticulate objects of history. Better be inarticulate, because if you say anything, you blow your brains out, right? That's how we've experienced this. That's how the colonial peoples of the world have experienced this relationship for a very long time. But then what began to happen, of course, is that as this movement began to speak for itself, as it got off his knees and off his belly, singing hymns and turning itself willingly to be brutalized, sometimes on international television. And what happened, of course, is the U.S. government initiated a fierce, brutal counterinsurgency war that was not unlike the wars that they initiated against the other peoples around the world. In fact, the Black Revolution of the 60s met the same fate as Black Revolution around the world. The 1960s, of course, that you saw, the leader, Kwame Nkrumah, who was the first independent president of what they now call Ghana, and who said that Ghana will never, ever, ever be free until all Africa is free, and who actually struggled to build a movement to unite African people around the world. 1966, of course, he was overthrown by the U.S. government. In 1957, an incredible man, his name was Dagon Kimathi. Most of you have never heard of him before. He led an organization called the Kenyan Land and Freedom Army. Most of you have never heard of that before. It was known as Mau Mau. And Kimathi is the one who had said that it is better to die on your feet than to live on your knees for fear of colonialism. And Kimathi is the one who raised up a mighty organization in Kenya. It's really interesting because the slogan of that organization was what? Uhuru. That's why we say Uhuru, because of the influence of the Kenyan Land Freedom Army. And they put on the ground thousands of people who were fighting for independence and freedom for African people in Kenya. But they weren't just fighting against direct white colonial power. One of the things that made Kimathi and the Kenyan Land Freedom Army so significant was they fought against direct white power, colonialism as it's called, and they fought against indirect white power, or white power in blackface, neo-colonialism as it's called. And in fact, our oppressors attempted to turn African people off and away from because hate Mau Mau. Because they said, well, Mau Mau, they're killing your people too. That's because our oppressors did not understand what we understood. That Wilson Good is not the people. That Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice are not the people. That Barack Obama is not the people. They are the enemy. The people are the workers and the peasants and the people who suffer the consequence of their policies and the existence of imperialism. Yes. And so we saluted and applauded what Mau Mau was doing in Kenya. But of course they finally, after a number of years, 1957, and Kimathi was an incredible leader. And one of the things that made me smile when I mentioned Kimathi here in Philadelphia is because the first time most people ever saw what they call dreadlocks, it was on the heads of the Kenyan Land Freedom Army, Mau Mau. And I think about that because I remember that Wilson Good, the neo-colonial puppet thug, right, who Mau Mau was fighting against in Kenya, dropped the bomb on the dreadlock wearing Mau Mau of this era right here in Philadelphia, which makes us truly believe that Fred Hampton was right when he said, you can kill a revolutionary, but you can't kill a revolution. Because Uhuru still lives, notwithstanding the fact that they captured Kimathi finally. And they beheaded him, and they did other terrible mutilations to his body. And after doing that, they went into a prison, and they got this guy who was the Jesse Jackson of his period, who was the Barack Obama of his period. And then, because it had become clear, because the Mau Mau fought up against the British Empire, they fought the British Empire for years and almost won the struggle by themselves, without assistance from Africans who were in Uganda, without assistance from Africans who were in Somalia, without assistance from Africans who were in Tanzania and the United States and other places, the Mau Mau by themselves fought the British Empire that bragged about having presiding over an empire upon which the sun never set. This is what Kimathi and Mau Mau took on and almost beat them, making homemade weapons, had their own weapons factory, etc., and held them for years and years and years. And so they killed Kimathi. But they knew that African people had reached a place that change was coming. But notwithstanding the fact that they killed Kimathi, change was coming. And so what they decided to do after killing Kimathi was to define for African people what change should look like. And they went into a prison and took the Jesse Jackson, the Barack Obama of that day. His name is Jomo Kenyatta. And then made him the president. And then told the Africans in Kenya, now you're free. But they made this war against us around the world. They overthrew Nkrumah. And Ghana now has a black president. And they said, look at Ghana's. They murdered Patrice Lumumba. There's a white man who was with the CIA at the time and who participated in the murder of Patrice Lumumba, one of Africa's greatest sons. And he brags about having one of Lumumba's teeth as a souvenir. They mutilated him. They burned him. They put him in a vat of acid and what have you. This white man has one of his teeth. But the point is that people were fighting for freedom. The Guatemalans wanted freedom. The U.S. went in and overthrew it. The people of Iran wanted freedom. when Mossadegh was the elected president of Iran. It was the United States government that overthrew the government of Mossadegh in 1954-55 and put the Shah in power so that they can continue to steal the oil. That was there. This is the history. This is the history of people who are resisting, trying to fight to take back their resources, take back their lives, their sovereignty, etc. And Europe and the United States did everything they could to make sure it didn't happen. In fact, in the murder of Patrice Lumumba, there was a race that was going on between the French, the Belgians, and the United States to see who was going to kill him first. The U.S. had codenamed him Barracuda. And then, of course, among the things they did was to criminalize him to as many people in the brains and minds of as many people as possible to make it something legitimate. And since everybody knows on the whole planet Earth that anybody who doesn't want to be with white people must have something wrong with them. See, everybody knows that. Must be crazy or have some other serious problem that justifies doing whatever is necessary to get rid of them. And so, in this country, of course, we saw the assassinations of Malcolm, we saw the assassination of King, and of course in both instances we're supposed to believe that the government that had worked at killing them for all those years and tried to get them killed and wiretapped them and did all those other things didn't do it and don't know who did it. Right. We saw in 1969 alone more than 30 members of the Black Panther Party assassinated in this country. 1972, I think it was, where Rizzo arrested some Panthers and then stripped them naked and had the press to come out and take pictures of them to demoralize the African populations. These are your leaders. These are the ones who are fighting for your freedom. See? And then, of course, to bring joy, happiness, and comfort to the white population as a consequence of having defanged the resistance in the minds of many people. And then finally, over a period of assassinations and jailings, we don't even know how many people went to prison during that period. I was in and out of prison so often, I had to read the newspaper to find out where I was. And we don't even know how many people were assassinated. We know some numbers, but we don't even know how many people. And finally, after having crushed a revolution in this country, they raised up these puppets, these neo-colonial puppets, as representatives of black power. Now, Wilson Good is Huey P. Newton. I'm not going to call all the names. Jesse Jackson, of course, is now Martin Luther King. And I don't mess with it too much right now. But you get the drift. And so many of our leaders were killed and assassinated. And a form of imperialist peace was reestablished. And then charity became, again, the order of the day. And everybody could feel good about helping the poor Negroes. Or you can send 50 cents and have your own little child, and we'll send you a picture and all these other things that you can get and can feel quite good about it, and good about yourself, and good about the wonderful things that you are doing, and still go to the mall. Right? And that's the way it was. And whole... Not only was that something that was that influenced how the North American European populations acted, but it also influenced how so-called leaders in the African community presented and represented themselves. Because soon it's clear that revolution is dangerous, and you can be a quote-unquote revolutionary in name. You don't have to do anything. You can be super black. You can, you know all the right things to wear and all the right things to say, which direction to pray in. You can hold up the red, black, and green. You can have study groups on a regular basis. Just don't mess with imperial white power. You can get grants. This all over the world, not just here, all over the world. Everywhere you go, there's a whole international circuit of NGO, non-governmental organizational representatives that just chance, how do you say that word? Say it. Traveling everywhere. All over the globe. You meet them in conferences, and they get invited to conferences. They are brought out of impoverished Africa where people are lucky if they earn a dollar a day, and they are feted in luxurious hotels, good liquor, good food, the rest of that, there's a whole, and you know what to say in order to get invited back the next time. And so there's a whole army of these forces who say they speak about the African condition, some coming from here and from various other places around the world. It's easy today. But somebody has thrown a monkey wrench into the process. And increasingly what we begin to see is that peoples are reclaiming the right to our own resources and to freedom. That's why Hugo Chavez has become the poster child now for everything evil. Not everything, but a lot of what is evil, because there's Mugabe who's talking about taking back the land from the damn white people who was the president who said that it belongs to us because we stole it square and fair or something to that effect. There's Mugabe, you know, who had the audacity to take it back, the land back, or at least to be associated with that movement. There's Chavez. There's Cuba, of course, who they've encircled and starved for a few generations, etc. But growing numbers, Evo Morales and people in Bolivia, everywhere you see this whole militant development that's happening everywhere around the world. The Palestinians, no matter how much genocide they initiate, they continue to fight and demand the right to their land back from that criminal occupation, military, white nationalist, settler colonial occupation. The people in Iraq where the Bush regime thought they were going to have a cakewalk to just take their freedom and take their sovereignty and take their oil and use it as a beachhead to control all the Middle East, they keep fighting and resisting. And what is becoming clearer also is the relationship between the struggles of the oppressed peoples around the world and the economic foundation of the entire capitalist system. And so now, this has been something that's been bothering the imperialists for a while. More and more people are crossing that artificial border of separating of what they call Mexico from this country. And the reality is that change is upon us. And the imperialists saw the change upon us, and the far-seeing, most thinking representatives of the imperialists again tried to grab this change and define it in a way that serves imperialism as opposed to serving the vast majority of the peoples. And they selected somebody who looks like most of the oppressed peoples around the world, looks like most of the world, looks like most of the people on the planet. Found somebody who looks like most of the people on the planet, selected him, and then had him elected as president of the empire. And he ran on a campaign of change, change, change. But he didn't have to tell us about change. Hugo Chavez was saying change, change before he ever heard of it. And the people in the Mexican liberation movement were saying, si se puede, yes we can, before he even learned what the word meant. He appropriated it, appropriated the concept of change. The imperialists did that. And now they want to tell us, you got change. That's what the objective is. Convince us, you got change. This is what you want, this is what you got. Right? Of course, what they've done is use the Kenyan solution. Same government that killed Malcolm X killed Martin Luther King, killed Fred Hampton, killed Bobby Hutton, killed revolutionaries and stuck them in prisons, now have given us our leader. That's the Kenyan solution. And that made a lot of people feel so good. Especially, it's really interesting because we see in our movement that African people love and support Barack Obama because they think it means black power. And white people love and support Barack Obama because they know it doesn't mean black power. Oh yes, they do. And only the dummy Negroes are the ones who are lagging behind recognition. This is the first of the presidential candidates who came out against reparations was the bomb in Harlem, New York, of all places, during one of the first so-called election debates. Obama is the one who denounced black fathers. Used to just be O'Reilly who was doing that kind of stuff, right? Now Obama does that kind of stuff, but I got a story. I was in Kenya a while ago and I met this African young man, came up to me. He said, my name is Otieno. He says, my family comes from the same family as Obama. He said, my name means nightfall. Obama means corrupt or broken. He said, names mean something. I said, tell me about it. But so you have this struggles of oppressed peoples now to change. And you have the oppressor trying to define what change is. And what I want to say to this conference on today is that I appreciate your being here. But I want to tell you that we're not looking for charity. That you have a responsibility like I do. If you know enough about our movement, you'll know that when we talk about African internationalism, it doesn't just explain the condition of black people in the world, it explains the people of everybody in the world. It shows us our connection to the struggles of oppressed peoples around the world and our connection to Europeans and North Americans as well. It helps us so that we were able, when the Sandinista revolution kicked off in Nicaragua, We didn't even know any Nicaraguans, but we found some and turned over all the resources at our command to the Nicaraguan revolution because that was our responsibility, because we hate oppression, because we hate slavery, because we believe that we have a responsibility to stand on the side of the future and progress, and the future of the world is a liberated future. And we are opposed to anybody, anything, any government that is against the freedom of the peoples of the world, that takes oppression and slavery. We are opposed to it. It's just that simple. Does that mean, are you opposed to it? Damn right, America too. First of all, that humanity has never known a greater, more vicious, more oppressive imperialism than what you have in American imperialism. Never in the history of the humanity has there been an imperialism worse than this imperialism. And beyond that, it can do nothing right. It can do nothing right. Everything it does. When you see America moves, criticize it, and then find out what the hell it was all about. That is the way it is. So I thank everybody for coming out and participating in this conference. But I have to tell you that the reason it may have appeared that charity was the order of the day is because we have been without the obvious overt resistance of oppressed people for so long now. But that is changing. And now people have to make choices. Because, yes, we do community gardening and we do furniture stores, and we do other kinds of things like that, but that is not all we do. We do these things as a part of a whole revolutionary program because we are determined that African people must be free. that there is something wrong with, on the one hand, living in a country where at every Olympics we see Africans winning gold here, gold there because of athletic physical prowess. But on the other hand, the African in America has a lifespan 7 years less than the average white person. That don't make no sense at all. All the evidence shows a physical superiority on the one side, but we die earlier, making 54 cents or something like that to every dollar that comes into a white household comes into an African household. Something is wrong with that. We want to see an end to the humiliation of African people. You know this thing they call education. I just have to just say briefly about that because you're so bad for your education, you don't, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But you know how they do education, right? Because education is this thing where the student is just this vessel where the educator dumps all of this knowledge and information. Student doesn't bring anything to it. You're just this vessel to have all this stuff drop into your brains, into your personality. What that means, of course, is that if you're African, if you're Mexican, if you're anything other than European or white, right? None of your experiences even come into the equation of what they call education because you ain't got nothing to bring to the table. You're just there as a vessel to receive all that they're going to drop into your brains, into your very soul, the essence of who you are. You understand what I'm saying? You're just an empty vessel, and you show up, and they just put all this stuff in your brain. And the more you absorb what they put in your brain, the more educated you are. And they can tell when you are educated because you stop acting like yourself and start acting like them. Oh, yes. Education for Africans, Mexicans, and the rest of us is a consequence of a civilizing mission where the white world imposes on us a whole new identification. So evidence of our being civilized is how much we aggregate white people, and that's why young Africans instinctively, without even the benefit of this analysis, know that they cannot cooperate with that stuff. Yeah, they wear their pants to their ankles, they turn their hats sideways, they do everything rather than act like the white man wants us to act. And of course, when they act like that, they're not civilized, they're criminal, there are all these other negatives that get thrown at them all the time. And I say, right on, I want to try to win you to the revolution because there's a way out of this stuff. You see? Oh, yeah. I'm telling you what I know, because, you know, I've been a victim of this civilizing process, as have most Africans who have, quote-unquote, been successful in education. The ones of us who are successful in education, you see, are the ones who, the minority, who the system expects will rule the rest of us for them. The others, they kick out. If any sign of resistance, your ass gone. Defiance. You ever heard of a crime of defiance? They still do that in school here too, don't they? Yeah. You know, and so you don't act right, you get kicked out. And then they mold you. And they ain't even new. I'm going to say this and sit down. There's a story somebody was telling me about the French in West Africa. And part of what they do, of course, is they make, we talk about teaching and education, an assault on the belief system of the people. You have to attack the belief systems of people. You can't just win physically. You have to destroy a whole belief system, psychological warfare, ideological warfare. And the biggest thing they use against us is this thing they call Christianity or religion. Not just Christianity, but religion. In our instance, it's Christianity. So when the French wanted to convert these Africans into Catholics, But they were having a problem because the Africans would not follow these white Catholics. So they kidnapped African children, little boys. And they put them in whatever you call these institutions where they're going to make priests of them. They denied them the right to use their own language. And any African child caught using his own language had a rotting goat's head tied around his neck. And the only way he could get this rotting goat's head from around his neck was to snitch on another African who used his own language. In St. Petersburg, there's a war going on now. They call against the so-called culture of don't snitch in the African community. It's happening all over this country, isn't it? But you see, the whole thing is transformation. It's to transform us into something that works against our own interests. And so this is how the French eventually were able to come up with black priests who then would be trusted by Africans because they were African, right? And would be effective in attacking the belief system of the African population to make us susceptible to French and colonial ideological assault. That's the same thing that happens to us now. They don't tie a goat's head around your neck, but they make a serious assault on the community, on our young people, the biggest slander campaign you can ever hear on young Africans, you know. Because and then they have this thing about Africans who hate education. They say that any African who acts smart, who is smart in school, an African can't be smart in school because other Africans will attack him or her for acting white. Now, any Africans know what I'm talking about. We know what acting white is. We know what acting white is. And yes, Negroes do act white. Don't they act white? You know what I'm talking about, don't you? And that ain't got nothing to do with being smart, is it? That's got to do with acting white, right? but the thing is that's what the objective is, to transform us. So there's a whole resistance happening around the world. I just left Kenya, as mentioned before, the ASI conference we just had in Kenya, which was attended, by the way, by at least one African from Somalia. And I mention that because, you know, they just kidnapped this youngster, this 15-year-old youngster. They call him a pirate because he stopped one of the pirate boats, real pirates out there. Here's a guy in a fishing boat. He's got a fishing boat, right? He's the pirate, right? And this huge trawler that's dumping toxic waste, overfishing the area, doing all these criminal activities, and the kid is the pirate. Been there, done that. But just left, before that, we had a conference in West Africa and Sierra Leone. We're building a worldwide, an international organization of African people to win our freedom and take back our resources. Doesn't make any sense to me that Africans in Philadelphia, young people should be killing each other for bling when most of the bling in the world belongs to us any damn way. We just take it, you know, from those who got the whole thing. And that's our responsibility. We have a responsibility to be free. And we have a responsibility to be free on our own terms, just like any other free people. And you, North Americans and Europeans, have a responsibility to support that, even if it means going against your own government. That Africans do not exist as something to, you know, some kind of pastime or entertainers and what have you for white people. I've even had a good white person who was concerned because we have a situation in one public school system where Africans, every year an African is in the public school system, the level of achievement goes down. In this one system I'm talking about, only one third of the Africans graduate with a diploma. So we're struggling to educate our own children, serve our own school system. And this really nice white liberal, she came to me and she says, but my children, you know, I just think it's so wonderful because my children, if you do that, my children who now have an opportunity, they can go to school and they can be with black children and they can experience black culture and another kind of culture. But no, never send our children to school for white people to have experiences. Children go to school to get a goddamn education. And no matter how nice you think you are, that, you know, that's the Madonna stance. I'm not interested in that. You know, you should be joining with me to make this struggle so that I can guarantee my children going to have an education. But instead of that, you're talking about what your children are going to miss because my children are not there being flunked and not only flunked, but facing all kinds of ideological assaults every damn day, humiliation, etc. She thought she was being nice. And thus, you know, we have to change some of our ways of understanding the world. And part of what I really want to say is that the resistance here is going to be more and more pronounced every day. We have people who yesterday, sometimes they thought they were our friends, and that the moment we took a stance in defense of African people that made them uncomfortable, they discovered they were really in it only for the charity. And that they didn't want to be our friends anymore because we were audacious enough to say that that African has a right to defend himself. Our community has a right by any means necessary to defend itself from terror. If you're not denouncing Barack Obama for giving the order to gun down a 19-year-old kid who hadn't killed anybody, if you're not denouncing Barack Obama for sending troops into Afghanistan right now to kill an impoverished population and take their land and resources and also to make it possible to run a gas, natural gas pipeline through there for major U.S. corporations, if you're not ready to be upset, I mean seriously upset, not just discussion-wise upset, but to cut him off at the knees like you try to cut us off at the knees because we stand up for African people, for even promising to since keep at least 50,000 troops in occupied Iraq. If you're not upset that he is even now refusing to turn Guantanamo, not just in the prisons in Guantanamo, but turning Guantanamo back over to the Cubans, that's Cuban territory. Don't tell us that a condition for your support for this movement is that we can never do anything that upsets you. That's like, again, the Indians who want their land back and the Iraqis who want their oil back, you know, changing situations for you. Africans are going to be free. And what we call on you is to be able to unite and join Uhuru solidarity. Freedom solidarity. Not charity solidarity. Uhuru.
Uhuru, that was African People's Socialist Party Chairman O'Malley Shetela, May 2nd in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Uhuru solidarity, not charity. This concludes our broadcast, and this concludes the broadcast day for uhururadio.com. Tune in again next Sunday.